All right, so this is the fourth podcast on the topic of managing innovation processes. So far, we've looked at two formal mechanisms to manage innovation processes: the direct approach, exemplified by stage gate systems, and an indirect approach, exemplified by different management accounting measures. Both of these formal approaches are based on ideas and innovations being subject to managerial decision making, and that in turn requires them to be formally revealed to management. Managers need to know about innovations if they're going to make decisions and calculations around them. In the third podcast, we looked at how innovations developed in R&D units are not always revealed and thus also elude managerial decision making. R&D workers engage in bootlegging, where they work on projects informally and without managerial approval. They might do this for all kinds of reasons. Prominent one is to postpone managerial evaluation of their innovations until the innovations are de-risked and take on less explorative characteristics. R&D workers might also work on pet projects that they enjoy or that they will ultimately pursue outside of their organization. Recall that many of Christensen's disruptive innovations did not originate de novo in the entrepreneurial organization, but were in fact developed within, but rejected by, an incumbent organization. In this podcast, we're going to broaden this idea of an unobserved amount of innovation occurring in the wider organization, and we're going to do that by looking at a study of innovation in police and military organizations that Mia Hartman and I have been working on. The paper is Innovation in Bureaucracy Revisited, a comparative ethnographic study of innovation hiding practices. It's a working paper, it's available on SSRN, and so it's emphatically not yet published, and it has not yet gone through the peer review process that papers undergo to weed out mistakes, erroneous conclusions, loose and fast interpretations of the literature, etc. It's also something that we're currently working on revising, so know that it's neither finished nor vetted for errors. It's a work in progress, basically. But presented here to show you something about the workings of the academic process, which I think is generally helpful to readers, and because it speaks to the issues that we're dealing with in this particular class on the management of innovation processes by sort of complicating the idea of innovation being manageable. The paper's starting point is the sort of widely accepted idea that bureaucracy impedes innovation. In private firms, as Abernathy suggests, the pursuit of efficiency forces organizations to basically become bureaucratic and thereby sacrificing their ability to engage in more explorative innovation. Bureaucratization is, he'd say, incommensurable with high rates of product innovation and with high rates of adaptability. You can't have both. In public bureaucracies, if we're going to draw on the classical sociologist Max Weber, innovation is typically sacrificed. To ensure due process and consistency, you don't want, as sort of a popular example, you don't want your tax inspector to be wildly innovative, to be wildly adaptable. You want them to basically sit in the iron cage of the bureaucracy and the bureaucratized process, and to dispassionately treat everyone pretty much the same according to the same set of rules. Those rules have to be explicit and enforced uniformly by everyone. Now, you'd get the impression too, if you read Paul Adler's account of bureaucracy in Perspectives on the Productivity Dilemma, but then you'd also see that Adler has an idea that bureaucracy can in fact be innovative in the presence of appropriate conditions, right? High levels of trust being the most central one, and one that is all too easily undermined by the capitalist relations of production, according to Adler. So the right way to think about it is that it's not so much bureaucracy per se, but coercive bureaucracy that, while sometimes efficient, is also often non-innovative. But that, as we argue in this paper, may also be wrong. What may in fact be the case is that innovation is commonly occurring in bureaucracies, but also commonly hidden. enabling bureaucracies may not be more innovative than coercive ones, but it may be that hiding will just be more common in coercive settings. That can create the appearance that coercive bureaucracies are less innovative than enabling ones, while in practice, it might very much be the same. We don't know. Depends on the extent of hidden innovation. Now, the theory and managerial practice that follows from that theory may, in other words, be wrong because of errors of empirical observation. If you were able to observe the dark matter of hidden innovation, you wouldn't believe that coercive bureaucracies are non-innovative. And if you wanted to make a coercive bureaucracy more innovative, in quotes, as a manager, you'd actually want to start off not necessarily making it more innovative, but instead trying to surface what is in fact already happening, but happening secretly. To make this argument, we conducted a pretty extensive ethnographic study across four sites, two police districts, two military units, and I basically encourage you to make up your own mind about whether what we have is good data or not, but I'll summarize what we did. First, we chose pretty prototypical coercive bureaucracies as cases. If you want to study something qualitatively, it sometimes makes sense to go to extreme sites to see a phenomenon play out in a very clear way. And both police and military are pretty much the canonical examples of coercive bureaucracies. Then, in these four sites, we collect the data through a total of 3 years of participant observation, coupled that with interviews focused towards the end of the process, mostly on innovation histories. We collected 112 innovation histories, which are basically deep accounts of these specific innovations that we observe being developed in these organizations where innovation, you know, really shouldn't happen that much. We then code those 112 innovations and whether and how they're hidden. And we try to draw out through the empirical descriptions that we have of each, why they're hidden in the particular way they are. Because we have several sites, because we have so many innovations and cases where innovation, or in cases where innovators develop multiple innovations, we can look at factors shaping hiding at multiple levels, right? We can look at the individual innovation, we can look at the innovator, we can look at the organization. And that gets us to the explanation presented in the paper, which just for good measure is one that we're currently working on developing further. You're also totally free to make up your own mind. I encourage you to do so about the kind of innovations that we observe and how we should think about them in relation to organizations. Are they explorative, exploitative, supporting of organizational improvement, destructive of it, valuable, trivial? There are, I think, in the paper, lots of examples to illustrate what's at stake and some pretty crude summary statistics of what's going on. Not all innovations are described, and that's because the conditions for gaining empirical access was to promise people anonymity. As we mentioned in the paper, doing studies of organizational secrecy is not easy, and people don't necessarily share the secrets with you unless you promise to, you know, keep them secret. That's sort of the nature of the enterprise. And therefore, there is some masking involved of the data. As a consequence, it's also sort of difficult for us to assess in a very systematic way the implications of these innovations. What kind of effect do they have on performance? You can't really go out and assess that without disclosing the nature of the hidden innovations that we're dealing with. And then even if they weren't subject to anonymity, assessing performance implications absent some form of control group is really hard and associated with all kinds of uncertainties. And even if there weren't, how would you measure the value of an innovation that makes it possible to do things that was previously impossible? And especially when some of those things that were previously impossible was to actually live up to the organization's rules. That can sound sort of weird, but consider this example. In the military units that we studied, they use the Browning M2 machine guns, and you can look those up online if you're curious. And those machine guns have a buffer mechanism on the back plate, If you're really curious, you can Google heavy machine gun B3M4238 student handout. And that'll get you to a student handout that they use in the US Marine Corps. You can then turn to page 12 of that handout and you can see a drawing of the major components of the machine gun. And the mechanism that we're talking about is on what's called the backplate group, and it's placed between the two vertical handles on the backplate. Okay, now when you fire the machine gun, that buffer mechanism between the handles loosens, and so it needs to be tightened. There are, as you might expect from a cursory bureaucracy, pretty precise rules for how to do that. There's very little discretion in many aspects of bureaucratic organizing. Interestingly enough, those rules can change. And so while I was doing this particular part of our empirical work, a change was made stating that adjustment, which has previously been done using a visual cue, where you check the slot on the buffer mechanism was in vertical, basically it had to be done to a certain torque. Alas, no tool existed making that adjustment possible. It didn't exist. You'd need a torque wrench with an appropriate bit, and that bit did not exist. You couldn't, or at least it couldn't be procured through the military procurement system. And what then is a otherwise rule-following military mechanic to do? Well, one particular mechanic developed the tool himself, allowing him to actually live up to the formal rules, nominally improving the maintenance of the weapons and also the longevity of the weapon system, but not conferring a particular performance advantage. So how would you assess the value of something like that? It's a good question. Nonetheless, irrespective of its performance implications, this particular example does say something really interesting about innovation hiding practices. This innovation was not shared with the mechanic's superiors. Rather, it was what we called hidden in plain sight. The mechanic simply kept it in his workshop, safe in the belief that his managers would not recognize that it was being used. That's good for him because he wasn't allowed to make and use his own tools. To live up to labor safety rules, he has to use CE-certified tools only. And he also wasn't allowed to break military property to innovate, which he had done. So, like roughly half of the innovations that we observed, this innovation was deliberately hidden, right? The other half was used openly, but not actively revealed to managers, and certainly not shared in the idea management systems, suggestion boxes, and other systems that were available for workers to share their ideas and subject them to formal managerial evaluation. The openly used solutions were just used by the innovator without any diffusion efforts being made, except in one case that you can read about in the paper. The hidden solutions were used, but with the innovators actively trying to conceal them from superiors. In other words, in half the cases that we observe, or about half, people actually ensured that they actively took steps to avoid having their innovation subjected to managerial observation and managerial evaluation. So you can have all the stage gate systems in the world when these things don't enter into any kind of formalized evaluation process. So anyway, hiding the thing that we're interested in this particular paper happens in three different ways. There is the aforementioned hiding in plain sight, but you also get what we term evasive and collusive forms of hiding. Evasive hiding is what's closest to pure secrecy. You deliberately conceal an innovation, you keep it away from managerial observation, you keep the innovation and the use of it invisible. Collusive hiding is a more nebulous form of hiding where workers rely on the expectation that managers will not be actively looking for an innovation, either because they're busy doing other things, or informally because managers give their workers a zone of privacy to do this kind of innovation. And thus they keep the innovation less deeply, more tactically hidden. And then there is hiding in plain sight, where workers take advantage of the kind of knowledge gaps that exist in organizations, if you follow Brown and Dewitt's argument. Some work is just really hard to understand if you don't partake in it, and consequently some innovations can be hidden in plain sight because they're only going to be visible to people engaged in very particular practices, such as the working practices of the aforementioned military mechanic. Now, what drives these different behaviors is a combination of factors. The way managers are expected to react to innovations, whether they're seen as what we term Chandlerian or Weberian in their orientation, is the most central one. But organizational context and innovation level attributes sort of shape the hiding behaviors too. So basically, you have a multi-level set of interactions playing into the innovation hiding phenomenon. The paper develops the nature of those interactions in somewhat greater depth. And again, you should read this as an argument that you should, as always when reading a paper, actively decide whether you find persuasive. I will, however, try to say a few things about the implications that it might have if you do accept the argument, or that you might at least consider if you accept the argument somewhat. For one, it broadens up the issue that we've already discussed in relation to bootlegging. There is quite possibly a very large hidden, unobserved population of innovations, a largely empirically unrecorded number of innovations occurring not just in R&D but across organizations. And as always, when you're systematically barred, in this case because innovators' deliberate hiding efforts from observing, theorizing over, and managing the sum of innovations, mistakes will be made. I'm not saying that mistakes, and especially egregious ones, are made, but I think the paper does sort of raise the question, or problematize at least, whether bureaucracy does in fact hamper innovation. We don't know if the observations of hiding will generalize, but if they do, then there may be something to the assertion that what bureaucracy does do is not necessarily to discourage innovation, but to encourage innovation hiding. And that's, of course, a very different theory. Or it may be that bureaucracy discourages particular forms of innovation and encourages hiding of others, but appears to uniformly discourage all forms of innovation. And again, that's sort of a very different theory. And if there's a system to which innovations get hidden, ideas about the nature of innovations that might thrive within bureaucracy would also be distorted. Now, if the prevalent theories are inaccurate, then the managerial challenge of reconciling innovation and bureaucratic efficiency is not necessarily one of carving out distinct contexts or subunits. Instead, it'd be about finding ways to have innovators begin just to reveal their innovations, to provide them with infrastructure to develop their innovations outside the formal chain of command, or to have them share innovations laterally with peers without managers being involved. And that could be very meaningful. And that could very meaningfully call for a very different set of interventions. At the slightly deeper level, it raises a question about how innovation is managed in organizations and how it is actually manageable. Now, unlike the hidden R&D of bootlegging, the innovation hiding that occurs outside of R&D seems persistently hidden. Bootlegging, when it happens, seems to happen mostly to delay managerial evaluation, which can be meaningful to do for a range of reasons. Often we see that people who engage in bootlegging perform better, and that's because they get more time basically to develop their ideas, and then what they subject to managerial evaluation is considered more valuable. But innovation hiding, as we observe it in the police and military context that we studied, was not a transitory thing. People didn't hide for a while and then share, thereby just postponing when innovations would be subject to management and managerial evaluation. Instead, they hid with the intention of keeping innovations hidden, because it was by keeping innovations hidden that they could actually benefit from using them themselves. There's no real incentive to ever let the innovation be subject to managerial evaluation. Why should you? This would mean that organizations, for all the efforts put into various innovation management initiatives, may be really managing only a very small subset of the innovation that actually occurs. And it's not totally clear that that subset contains the most important innovations, those most worth managing.